tedious you or idiotical way. He just doesn't want to learn. He doesn't want to pay attention. Nor does he make the effort in doing so. Hence we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that in this holy month of Ramadan that we are in or we are coming into, that we are able to inculcate these characteristics that the Imam has mentioned as being the regimens and units of aql in ourselves, and to take away and to further and to distance ourselves from those regimens and units that are said to be that of jahl. Inshallah, we'll continue this tradition after the holy month of Ramadan. Until then, I ask you to pray for us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no
The debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kovat Ahwai. Iran's Natanz nuclear plant has been hit. A small explosion in what Iran has labeled as an Israeli act of terrorism. Nuclear terrorism, to be exact. And the timing could not be more suspicious in more ways than one. First, this happened on the week which was Iran's Nuclear Technology Week. Then it happened during the nuclear talks in Vienna between Iran and the world powers, minus the U.S. And third, it happened when the U.S. Defense Secretary was visiting Israel. Israel's act of sabotage and nuclear terrorism against Iran, the subject of this edition of the debate.
Israel has made no secret of its hostility toward Iran since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which led to the ouster of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi monarchy. Israel, which is also a fierce opponent of Iran's peaceful nuclear program, has been behind the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the past years. On Sunday, Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in the central province of Isfahan was hit by a power outage. Israeli media confirmed that the Mossad spy agency carried out a cyber attack on the site. Iran also blamed the Israeli regime for the incident.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. It can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
Said Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident will not slow down the country's nuclear program, rather it will speed up its advancement. He said the IR-1 centrifuges damaged in the blackout will be replaced with more advanced ones. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also accused Israel of sabotaging the Natanz facility and pledged revenge against Tel Aviv for the attack. Zarif suggested that the attack was an attempt to derail the talks held in the Austrian capital with the aim of reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. The European Union also said the incident in Natanz could have been an act of sabotage and warned against any attempts to derail the JCPOA talks, which will resume on Wednesday in Vienna between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal.
And the bottom line for us is that we are saying that we are rejecting any attempts to undermine or to derail the ongoing diplomatic activities to try to resolve all the open questions regarding Iranian nuclear deal. We try to resolve them through diplomatic means currently in Vienna in the ongoing process of talks and negotiations of the parties of the JCPOA and through our contacts with the United States.
Russia also expressed hope that the attack on the Iranian nuclear facility will not undermine the Vienna negotiations. The Sunday attack came as U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Israel for talks with Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed to do everything in his power to stop efforts for salvaging the JCPOA. U.S. media say Washington, which is Israel's closest ally, was not involved in the attack on the Natanz facility. But the timing of Austin's trip has raised doubts about the claim. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stressed that Tehran cannot trust promises made by the new U.S. administration regarding the revival of the JCPOA. Now the attack on the Natanz nuclear facility can deepen the distrust as the incident further questions the sincerity of such promises.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, former U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine intelligence officer Scott Ritter, joins us from Bethlehem in New York. We also have political analyst Said Mustafa Hoshesh, who joins us. Gentlemen, welcome. Scott Ritter, let me first start with you and get your reaction about what has happened. The Natanz uranium enrichment plant, where an act of terror has hit the plant's electricity distribution. What do you think about what has occurred?
First of all, we know it wasn't an act. This was a deliberate act, and the timing appears to have been deliberate, which means it was a well-planned attack, which means that the perpetrators of this attack, most likely Israeli intelligence, had goals and objectives that went beyond simply inflicting damage, which would have a political aspect attached to them. And I think, Iran has pretty much, done what the Israelis wanted it to do. Iran has condemned it, rightly so. Israel knew Iran would condemn it. But Iran, more importantly, from the Israeli perspective, has made a commitment to replace the damaged or destroyed IR-1 centrifuges, which are the only centrifuges currently allowed to operate in Iran under the Joint Comprehensive Program of Action, and replace them with more advanced designs. And this, I believe, is what the Israeli objective was all along, for Iran to commit to continued installation and operation of designs that are incompatible with its obligations under the Joint Comprehensive Program of Action. Yes, Iran says we are committed to do so under Article 26 of the agreement, which says that if the United States lifts nuclear sanctions, Iran can do away with its obligations. But Iran has said that every action it takes under Article 26 will be immediately reversible. I believe that Iran's commitment to install more advanced centrifuges, not only in Natanz, but to transfer the centrifuge enrichment capability from Natanz to the Fordow underground nuclear facility, represents a more permanent action, which will be difficult to rectify in light of its ongoing negotiations with the United States. And this was the purpose of the Israeli attack, to undermine the negotiations currently taking place between Iran and the United States about the Americans rejoining the JCPOA, lifting sanctions, and bringing everything back into compliance with the original intent of the agreement.
Okay. Mustafa Hoshesh, Iran has accused Israel of carrying out this act of nuclear terrorism. Do you think Israel is guilty?
Israel is definitely guilty. Let's remember that in similar cases in the past, they always pursued the policy of ambiguity. But in the last three cases, starting from a similar attack on a centrifuge hull at Natanz months ago, they have reduced ambiguity to, take the responsibility one way or another through the U.S. media outlets like New York Times reports, where they quoted unnamed U.S. officials saying that the U.S. is clean of such actions, and they pointed the finger at Israel. There is no other regime in the world to enjoy an attack on a nuclear civilian facility except for Israel. And of course, let's remember that they have been emboldened enough to acclaim and to be proud of what they've done. When they assassinated the Iranian civilian nuclear scientist, Dr. Fakhrizadeh, they couldn't hide that they were happy with that, and they took some kind of pride in saying that they have the power to assassinate civilians. But let me point out that I disagree with your other guest. I do believe that this has been a joint venture by the United States and Israel. The Americans are the main beneficiary of this action and similar actions in the past. It's nothing new. We have already experienced it in the past decade before the JCPOA talks. This is part of the United States' carrot and stick policy in order to push Tehran to the talks through increasing the costs and increasing the pressures. This is part of actually the maximum pressure policy that's still being pursued by the U.S. administration of Joe Biden.
I'm sorry to jump in, but hold on to your thoughts. Let me get a reaction then, if that's what you're disagreeing on with Scott Ritter. Scott Ritter, our guest there, says that this is something that both Israel and the U.S. cooperatively have executed, and the U.S. is a beneficiary in this case because it will want to pressure Iran to, have flexibility in the talks to get Iran to accept whatever it is that the U.S. wants. Do you see it that way?
Possible. Look, the United States is the world's worst negotiating partner. If I were the Iranians, I wouldn't believe a thing the United States said. I'm giving my country the benefit of the doubt because right now no evidence exists that links the United States, complicit in this attack. But the fact of the matter is Israel and the United States are joined at the hip policy-wise. We have shared interactions on the intelligence side of the house, the defense side of the house, the policy side of the house, and the likelihood of Israel carrying out an attack of this magnitude on Iran with this timing without anybody in the Biden administration knowing about it in advance is slim to none. So it's indeed possible, maybe even likely, that the United States and Israel were coordinated together on this. But, the United States has to distance itself because to come out and publicly acknowledge that there was an American role would destroy all confidence, not only on the part of Iran, which would have every right to be enraged by this act of nuclear terrorism, by somebody who wants to rejoin as a party to the Iran nuclear agreement, but also all the members of the JCPOA, Russia, China, France, Germany, Great Britain, the European Union, should all be outraged, not only by what Israel has done, but if the United States was complicit in this, with what the United States has done. It's totally incompatible with the spirit, letter, and intent of the negotiations that are ongoing in Vienna. So, I don't reject what he said. I acknowledge that it's a likelihood. There's no evidence of it right now, but logic dictates that the other gentleman is probably correct.
Well, Sayyid Masavah Hoshesh, the U.S. Has come out and made a statement on this. It has said that it was not involved in any attack on Iran's Natanz nuclear site and has, and this is the interesting part, and has no comment on speculation about the cause of the incident. The question is that the actual truth? Our guest says that U.S. does not speak an ounce of truth when it comes to certain things. And how could this not have involved the U.S., especially when you have the U.S. Defense Secretary in Israel when this happened, not only having conversations with his counterpart, but also the latest to have been with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu?
Let me raise the case like this. Ever since Trump took office, maybe a few months after he took office, he was accusing John Kerry that he was sending pulses to Iran to avoid business with Donald Trump and wait for a Democrat administration. True or not, when Joe Biden started his campaign, he started talking about Iran deal, that he is very much up for reviving the nuclear deal, that he would definitely get back to the nuclear deal. He talked to the CNN and he published actually a manifesto with regard to Iran. He was very much expressive about Iran policy and the nuclear deal. But as soon as he took office, he started talking about Iran, pretending that China and Russia and domestic problems like COVID-19 were his priorities. So this reloquence, it was meant to push Iran to give up its leverages. They said that if Iran is willing to revive the deal, then Tehran could, give up its modified actions under the deal and resume its obligations. Why? Because they wanted Iran to give up its leverages. But Tehran, the Iranian top supreme leader, said that Iran is in no rush. Then the Iranian parliament approved the bill, a law that included four leverages against the U.S. Three of them were of a nature of urgency and emergency as far as leverage on Biden was concerned. One was a halt of implementing the additional protocol to the NPT. when, of course, Iran and the IAEA struck a deal to extend it for 3 months one way or another, this move actually lost its urgency. There remain two others. That was, one, the enrichment to the 20% purity level. Second, Iran working on highly advanced centrifuge machines. It was then that Biden offered Tehran a deal, a partial deal, they called it preparatory steps, to stop these two leverages in return for releasing part of Iran's frozen funds or all of the funds that have been frozen and removal of a number of sanctions. Iran rejected it outright immediately. Then we can see they came for attack on Natanz. And let's remember, the last year attack on Natanz was also on a hall that was assembling, where they assembled highly advanced centrifuge machines. And let's remember that Joe Biden, who was reluctant to talk even about Iran 2 weeks ago, in a sudden change of heart under these leverages, these two moves and actions, in a sudden change of heart, he called his administration into immediate sessions and meetings to wrap up a policy on Iran. And then they called for talks with Iran. They pressured Europeans to summon Tehran to talks in Vienna. And they've been pressuring Iran for talks. So they have been doing anything and everything to take away these two leverages, hoping that Iran would soften its tone, after it loses these two leverages and would agree with the U.S. Okay. to a partial removal of sanctions and direct talks with the United States. One more point, and I wrap it up. One other purpose of this is that once you stop Iran's leverages and undermine Iran's power and hand in such confrontation with the U.S. over the JCPOA, then there will be marathon talks. That's one of the purposes of the United States. They want to lengthen the duration of the talks, hoping that they could wear off Iran's resolve through marathon talks.
Okay, well, Scott Ritter, first of all, this needs to be addressed by you. Do you think that what has happened is going to affect the talks that are happening in Vienna, and if so, how?
Good. I mean, it could. I happen to believe that the Biden administration is desperate to bring an end to the crisis around the JCPOA at this time. It recognizes several realities, one of which is that Iran is about to have a national election in which a new presidential administration will be brought in, one that's more than likely far more conservative than the present administration of Hassan Rouhani, and one that will be more in concert with the position of the Iranian parliament when it comes to Iran's nuclear program and international attempts to curtail it. So there's a window of opportunity to strike, and they want to strike. The other issue is there's a domestic imperative. You know, the United States has created this artificial notion of a breakout window, the one-year breakout time. The entire Joint Comprehensive Program of Action is built around that, constraining Iran's nuclear program so that if it decided to stop cooperating, it would take them 1 year to enrich enough uranium to produce a single fissile weapon, a nuclear weapon. And that would give the United States enough time to come up with a counter, whether military, diplomatic, or a combination thereof. Right now, Iran has blown past that one-year mark. In fact, if Iran continues to install advanced centrifuges, this breakout window, which is an artificial construct, it doesn't exist except in the minds of American politicians. But that's the dangerous thing, that the American politicians in Congress and in the White House are convinced that Iran will be able to produce a bomb rapidly, and that the best hope is to get the JCPOA back in play. But remember this. The United States never intended to allow the JCPOA to reach its endgame state, meaning that at some point under the JCPOA, all restrictions would be lifted and Iran would be allowed unrestricted enrichment under Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty without constraints, as long as it's for peaceful purposes. That will never happen. The United States will never let that happen. Barack Obama said as much. He said, we're just buying 13, 14, 15-year time And then we'll deal with this down the road. If Iran continues to insist on wanting to enrich, we'll have to come up with a way to stop it. And that's the policy of the Biden administration. So even if they're able to navigate these troubled diplomatic waters and come up with an arrangement with Iran that allows the JCPOA to come back into full force, Iran should not, you know, pretend or mislead itself into thinking the United States is just going to walk away and say, that's it, the JCPOA is done. Oh, American policy has been and will always be to deny Iran the ability to have unrestricted enrichment of uranium.
Okay, final question to you, Sir Mohsen Abbas. I'm sorry, Khoshchesh, apologize for that. Where do you see the talks going? How has this affected? If you can do that in about 2 minutes' time.
I believe that it's the move with the goals that I just said in mind, the Israelis and Americans, this has been a joint venture to soften Iran's tone, to weaken Iran's stance. But I believe it would backfire. Iran would definitely do a number of reciprocal actions. First and foremost, I believe Tehran's stance would remain tough, and they would even toughen their tone. There are calls in Tehran already to call for a halt or stop or ending any kind of talks in Vienna until the world powers, the IAEA and others, take action against Israel and do their duty or do something for world peace and security. Otherwise, Iran would have would be entitled to the right to retaliate, and this would escalate tensions. Therefore, the world powers and the IAEA are duty-bound to take action against this act of terrorism, nuclear terrorism. And in addition to toughening tone, I believe, by Tehran, if they continue the talks in Vienna, they would toughen tone. And after that, maybe after a few months, we would see Iran's reciprocal action one way or another through cyber attack or through the military or whatever, because if they don't stop the Israeli atrocities, let's remember that this could have happened a day earlier when Iranian officials were visiting the facility, and this could have killed them, you know. This could have killed the Iranian experts and politicians as well as nuclear scientists in there. This could have wreaked havoc on the environment by radioactive pollution. Therefore, Tehran would definitely make Israel and the United States pay for that. Otherwise, they would be emboldened to scale up and to enhance their threats and widen their threats to Iran.
Okay, I do have more time here. So, Scott Ritter, I'm going to ask you something that you mentioned about the centrifuges. Now, we have had the Atomic Energy Organization head, Dr. Ali Akbar Saleh, is saying that the damaged centrifuges, and I'm quoting him, will be replaced with even more powerful ones. You talked about how that puts Iran on a path of it being irreversible, if I heard you correctly, if you can expand on that a little bit more, because Iran has always said that it can reverse the actions that it is taking when it comes to its nuclear program in terms of the way forward that it is going with it.
Well, there's a couple things. Not only did they say that they're going to replace the damaged IR-1 centrifuges with more advanced designs, but they also spoke of transferring enrichment capability out of Natanz into the Fordow underground facility, which is a much more difficult target for Israel, the United States, or anybody else who wants to physically interdict Iran's enrichment capability. This is impermissible under the JCPOA. And, you know, if for Iran to live up to its obligation to reverse everything that it has done citing Article 26 of the JCPOA, Iran would have to be willing to transfer everything out of Fordow back to Natanz, decommission all of these new centrifuges. I'm not saying that's impossible, but I'm saying that it makes things much more difficult for Iran to reach compliance with its obligation to reverse the measures undertaken under Article 26. And I think that's what Israel intended. I think Israel intended to compel Iran to escalate its enrichment activities in a manner that are incompatible with the JCPOA, thereby complicating the negotiations in Vienna. Whether Israel did this in concert with the United States or independent of the United States, only history will able to tell, but this is a deliberate effort on the part of Israel, most likely some elements within the Biden administration, to sabotage the negotiations that are taking place in Vienna right now.
Okay, very well. We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Former UN weapons inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine intelligence officer Scott Ritter there. And thank you, political analyst Seyed Mostafa Khoshchesh. That brings us to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tatlis, goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Thumma innakum ba'da dhalika lamaytun.
Then indeed, after that, you are to die. Then indeed, you, on the day of resurrection, will be resurrected.
Then, verily, after that, you shall die. Then verily on the day of resurrection, you will be raised again. So as you have been previously with us, the chapter started describing some of the most important attributes and characteristics of the true believers, the ones who are from among the successful. After that, mentioned the vast and unique rewards in store for them. And right after that, in three verses, described how this human being has raised and where exactly he has come from. How complex and complicated thing, which is human being, is made out of the simplest thing. Now, in these verses, Allah shows us that death is certain and definite. Here it will be appropriate to mention a part of one of the sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam on this subject. He alayhi salam says, if there was anyone who could secure a ladder to everlasting life or a way to avoid death, it was Sulaiman bin Dawood alayhi salam who was given control over the jinn and men, along with prophethood and a great position before Allah. But when he finished what was his due in sustenance in this world and exhausted his time, the bow of destruction shot him with the arrow of death. So by having a general view on these verses along with the previous ones, we understand that since the previous verses mentioned the stages of development of man for which Allah admired himself, and these two verses talk about the final stages, we can infer that these two verses are talking about the perfection after death. The growth and the raising starts in this world, but perfection is not achieved in this world, and perfection is actually after death. After touching on the subject of monotheism and the origin of man, the issue of resurrection is mentioned in a very delicate and beautiful way.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The verse implies that man, with all his marvels and wonders, cannot live eternally in this world, and a time must come when his marvelous structure will fall apart. So the verse says, ثُمَّ إِنَّكُمْ بَعْدَ ذَلِكَ لَمَيِّتُونَ. Then verily after that you shall die. And this seems to be another stage of perfection for human beings. The Prophet ﷺ says, death is like a bunch of fragrant flowers for the believer, and death is beneficial for those who have made faith and piety the practice of their hearts. So this stage is different based upon what kinds of acts and deeds you've had during your life in the world. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, death is the cause of tranquility for the prosperous. So somehow, in some sense, it could be relative, because the Prophet in this regard has said, unexpected death is a relief for the believer and a wrath for the unbelievers. The nature of death is the same, but it differs based on which kind of actions you have had in the world. And actually, reminding yourself of when the death comes is one of those tricks to prepare yourself for when you will actually receive the rewards of your deeds. Or if someone is unbeliever, he would receive the wrath of Allah. Imam Hadi alayhi salam says, remember when you will be lying on the bed of death before your household, and neither can any physician prevent your death, nor can any friend help you. And this fact is actually emphasized in the next verse, that it actually expresses that death is not destruction, but a stage of perfection. So, in order to neutralize the idea that a person dies and therefore everything ends, which would make the magnificence of this creation pointless, Allah immediately says afterwards, ثُمَّ إِنَّكُمْ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ تُبَعْثُونَ. Then verily, on the day of resurrection, you will be raised again. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
The Islamic Jihad movement and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine held a sit-in in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. The event took place near the Israeli-controlled Erez crossing in northern Gaza. The move comes as thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to suffer from inhumane treatment and are being denied their basic rights. The Israeli regime has imprisoned nearly 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Many Palestinian prisoners suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment by Israel's prison service, who runs Israeli prisons.
The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine came together today to express solidarity with the prisoners who are languishing in Israeli jails. The conditions of prisoners are only getting worse as days go by under the watchful eye of the international community.
Palestinian prisoners are subjected to degrading conditions, including administrative detention, solitary confinement, and bans on family visits. Palestinians say that Arab countries normalizing relations with the Israeli regime are encouraging Tel Aviv to violate the rights of Palestinians.
The normalization by Arab regimes has badly affected the conditions of Palestinian prisoners. Normalization of ties with the Zionists is a betrayal of Palestine and the Palestinian prisoners. All Arabs must understand that the United States and Israel are the enemies of the Arab and Muslim nations.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians, who regard them as prisoners of war and as symbols of resistance against Israeli occupation. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, vowed to use all forms of resistance to free Palestinian prisoners.
The so-called peace deals will not free Palestinian prisoners. Only resistance can free Palestinian prisoners from Zionist jails. Capturing more Israeli soldiers to exchange them with Palestinian prisoners must be a top priority for all Palestinian resistance groups.
Statistics show that over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967 due to medical negligence.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Israel is currently holding some 5,000 Palestinians behind bars, including women and children. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The Yemeni army says two of its drones hit Jizan Airport and King Khalid Air Base, both in southwestern Saudi Arabia. The army says this is part of intensified attacks to retaliate Riyadh's ongoing war on Yemen.
We are entitled to carry out the attacks as part of our normal and legitimate right to respond to the escalation of Saudi Arabia and its comprehensive blockade on our country, and we promise the Saudi regime more painful operations as long as the aggression and siege continues.
His comments come as, over the past months, Saudi Arabia has either roundly denied any Yemeni attacks inside the country or claimed Yemeni missiles and drones were intercepted before making impact.
The Saudi regime realizes that it may lose face if people of the country come to know about the Yemeni attacks. The Saudi regime is controlling its people by force, and it is afraid of an internal revolution against the ruling regime. So, this is why Riyadh continues to avoid talking about the Yemeni attacks.
Military experts say the Yemeni army is well capable of expanding its attacks to a wider range of targets to make them more painful for Riyadh. They say this could inflict greater damage to Saudi Arabia economically and militarily.
Saudi Arabia must realize that the painful phase is yet to come. Saudi Arabia will lose its economic power and military capabilities in this phase. Saudi Arabia says its army is the sixth most powerful army in the world, but 6 years of war on Yemen have proven that the Saudi army is extremely weak and has achieved nothing, while the Yemeni military capabilities have increased. And I believe that the continuation of this war is further damaging to the kingdom.
The Yemeni army's escalation of retaliatory attacks is a response to the deadly Saudi-led aggression and siege that caused the deaths of tens of thousands of people, many of them women and the children.
Saudi Arabia has been calling for peace talks with Yemeni forces to stop their attacks while refusing to grant the demand to end its years-long war and siege on Yemen. This leaves the Yemeni army no option but to step up its retaliatory attacks against the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky held talks with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Istanbul. The visit comes amid tensions between Kiev and Moscow over Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. Meanwhile, Russia bulked up its military presence on Ukraine's eastern border, threatening military action. During the meeting, the two presidents spoke about ways of cooperation in different sectors and strengthening ties between the two countries, including free trade, tourism, and sports. Following the meeting, which was also attended by ministers from both sides, a number of agreements were signed.
Turkey strongly defends the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. We hope that the escalation in eastern Ukraine will come to an end and the conflict will be resolved through dialogue based on the Minsk agreement.
The United States, after informing Turkey as per the Montreux Convention, sent two warships through Turkish straits towards the Black Sea. Turkish Foreign Ministry said the warships will stay in the Black Sea until May 4.
The tension between Russia and Ukraine is increasing every minute. Ukraine is waiting for support from the EU and the US. But Russia has clearly expressed that Crimea is its red line and will not give it to Ukraine. I think this visit is aimed at sorting things out. Ukraine wants to make sure that Turkey is on its side, especially after the phone call between Turkish and Russian presidents.
Late on Friday, Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed with his Turkish counterpart over the phone the Ukraine crisis and the presence of U.S. warships in the Black Sea. Turkish president assured that Ankara's cooperation with Ukraine does not mean it is against Russia. Analysts believe Turkey is trying to play the role of peacemaker in the region without taking sides. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
It was an utter shock for the destitute Rohingya community in India after the country's Supreme Court rejected the petition seeking halt on the deportation process. The court in its ruling said the deportation process could go ahead as long as the government follows due process. Now more panic has gripped the community as their last hope seems lost. Experts say the Supreme Court ruling will give a sense of relief to the community for a while from being deported instantly. They, however, believe the ruling doesn't stop the detention process. Rather,
It gives government more freedom to act swiftly.
Legal experts are shocked about the judgment, saying the country has welcomed refugees from several countries since decades, but adopted a hostile approach towards Rohingya in particular. India has no legislation on the refugees, and it considers Rohingya as illegal immigrants and a threat to national security.
They can be deported in accordance with the law. Now, which law? Law, according to the government, means the Foreigners Act. Now, Foreigners Act doesn't deal with refugees. Refugees are a different category of people. We had argued that even non-citizens, even refugees, have Article 21 rights, the right to life.
In recent weeks, dozens or more refugees were detained from New Delhi. The police maintains they have orders from higher authorities to carry detention process. Now, grief has befallen the destitute community. Rights activists say treating these refugees differently is a blow on India's ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family.
Why is it not our concern if there are refugees coming from there? It's not just the refugee law. There are so many laws dealing with the rights of children, the Human Rights Convention, the Civil and Political Rights Convention. They all talk about the principle of non-refoulement, which means that you cannot send somebody to a country or outside your territory where there will be danger to his life or limb.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
As the fourth wave of the coronavirus hits Iran, the country goes under another nationwide lockdown. From Saturday on, for at least 10 days, travel to and from high-risk cities will be banned, and non-essential businesses have to roll down their shutters. Schools, entertainment centers, and all public places will also be closed. Officials have avoided a total lockdown in Tehran, arguing that the capital city accommodates major national and international activities. The closures come amid a new wave of infections across Iran, which is believed to be the UK variant of COVID-19, entering the country from neighboring Iraq.
The first reason why our hospitals are once again overwhelmed with COVID-19 patients is the fact that British variant of the virus slipped into our country through our Khuzestan and Iran borders with Iraq. Now we are unfortunately faced with a fourth wave of the pandemic.
Authorities blame the new spike on the two-week traveling spree during the Persian New Year holidays, which started on March 21st. The number of confirmed coronavirus cases in Iran has passed the 2 million mark, and the total fatalities have surpassed 64,000. Vaccination of the most vulnerable groups of the society is underway in Iran with Russian-made Sputnik V vaccine. But the country is yet to launch a nationwide vaccination program. The government hopes to kickstart mass inoculation in 2 months using its own homegrown jabs.
While vaccines have also come in the ring to join the fight against COVID-19, the virus is still hard to knock out. Health officials advise everyone to take the new restrictions seriously. As they say, chances of survival are much lower for those who get infected with the UK variant of the coronavirus. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Dates, one of the fruits of paradise in Islamic tradition. With their paper-thin skin and juicy, sweet flesh, they have pride of place, especially on Muslim dinner tables.
Walk into any halal shop or indeed any supermarket here in the UK and you're bound to see dates on display. They come from many different places, including from Palestinian territories. And during Ramadan, they simply fly off the shelf. But could the Muslims living here in Britain, by taking dates to break their fast during the holy month, be unknowingly supporting the brutal Israeli occupation of Palestinians?
We put that question to the head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, an NGO running a campaign to boycott Israeli dates in the UK, now Israel's third target market.
that they were breaking their fast on a date which is being grown on stolen land, which is actually even unlawful, to break your fast with something which is haram.
Israel is one of the world's top five exporters of dates. In 2018, the UK was Israel's largest market for dates worth more than $25 million. Over half of those are grown in illegal settlements, ruled by the United Nations, the International Court of Justice, and several other international organizations as illegal and built on stolen Palestinian land. Not only that, Israeli settlers are set to employ low-paid Palestinian laborers, among them children, to do the back-breaking job of picking the dates. But how are Muslims and non-Muslim Palestinian rights activists to ensure that the dates they're eating are not from the illegal Israeli settlements?
Israelis, instead of coming out and saying product of Israel, they are hiding the identity of the dates. Packages like this, you know, Al-Malik, you know, a Muslim name, Arabic writing, product of Palestine. But when you look, you realize it's a con, because there is no company importer or distributor attached to this.
This year's call to boycott Israeli dates subscribes to the mission of the Global Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement that works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and pressure Israel to comply with international law.
We were in Britain number one importer of Israeli dates. Last year we informed everyone that we have become second, and this year we have become third. And at the same time, Palestinian dates are being sort of supported and imported more.
This Ramadan, when Muslims in Britain break their fast with dates, they'll be wise to ask themselves if the dates they're eating are helping ease the suffering of Palestinians, or are they going towards oppressing them? Saeed Purza, London.
A shock end to the week as British royal Prince Philip, the husband of Queen Elizabeth II, was pronounced dead on Friday. Just hours after the news broke, mourners began gathering to lay flowers for the late Duke of Edinburgh, who was the longest-serving consort in British history.
Following the death of such a prominent member of the royal family, British media, particularly the BBC, appear to have gone into whitewash overdrive, portraying the prince as some kind of charitable war hero, whilst totally glossing over his various disgraces, including his numerous racist outbursts and his support for colonialism.
Both headlines and government statements were awash with complimentary tributes. But British social media reacted very differently, with Black and Irish Twitter hashtags going viral, two groups competing to mock the royals' scandal-ridden legacy.
His record is incredibly checkered. He has indulged in numerous racist outbursts, and has indeed been a champion of British colonialism.
He said, for instance, back in 2002, a group of Indigenous Australians on a visit to see them with the Queen, he asked them, do you still throw spears at each other?
The British monarchy represents everything bad in their history, and so quite understandably, they have a different viewpoint on his death and what it means.
He said, if you stay here much longer, you will all be slitty-eyed. That's what he told British exchange students who lived in Xi'an in 1986.
The prince had a bad habit of offending minorities, but also represented detested British imperialist values.
If we're going to swear an oath of allegiance to anybody, it should be an oath of allegiance to the people, that elect us. We're all living in a democracy. We shouldn't be swearing an oath of allegiance, it seems to me, to an unelected monarchy.
150,000 COVID dead, 10 years of austerity, 120,000 of the most vulnerable and poor people dead. That's who I shed a tear from.
For now, the flag at the palace has been lowered, and on Monday, Parliament will honour the Duke with further tributes. But no matter how hard the establishment ignore it, the British royal legacy is tarnished. Robert Carter, London.
A
joint commission session between Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA comes to an end in Vienna. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says Iran's demand is clear. It will only come back to full compliance with the agreement after the U.S. lifts sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA. And Iran will also want to verify the sanctions lifting.
What we mean by verification is to see the effects of sanctions lifting in practice. So it is not enough for the U.S. to sign, you know, waivers or, I don't know, executive orders, whatever. Yes, they have to officially sign, but what matters for us is to see the effect of sanction lifting on the ground.
China's representative said the sides are narrowing down their differences. He said Beijing believes all the nuclear-related unilateral U.S. sanctions are illegal and should be lifted immediately to safeguard the JCPOA. The demand to lift all sanctions at once is a legitimate one, he said.
We think it's legitimate for them to lift it all at once, and it's an important issue.
But will they do it?
They have undertaken to do it, but we say that they must put it into action, turn their commitments into action.
Araghchi said he believes it is possible to get the job done sooner rather than later, but it depends on how willing and serious the other side is. After 3 days of intensive discussions within two working groups, the delegates agreed the talks are moving in the right direction. The Joint Commission will meet again on Wednesday amid hopes to maintain momentum. Homa Leski, Vienna.
Turkey has reported an unprecedented surge of daily coronavirus cases. The new infections stood at almost 55,000 on Wednesday, as the highest in the country since the outbreak of the pandemic last year. Turkish government plans to reduce the numbers during the upcoming holy month of Ramadan to welcome tourists again after the month. Turkish president said that he wants to see a significant reduction in the number of coronavirus infections by the end of Ramadan, as he announced last week that during the holy month, restaurants and coffee shops' work will be limited to takeout and delivery services only. Meanwhile, Turkey will continue to witness a daily curfew from 9 p.m. till 5 a.m. and total weekend lockdowns.
We aim to give a rest to our country during Ramadan and prepare it for better days after the Eid. If we could decrease the number of the cases to thousands, we will be able to catch the tourism season that is understood to be opened in May and the commercial activity that will be created by the tourism season.
Turkish Health Minister Fahrettin Koca said earlier that 75% of the new coronavirus cases in the country are from the more contagious variant detected in Britain. This as the country is still open for tourists who are not included in the curfew and lockdown measures. Some analysts believe the latest measures is the reason behind the sudden increase in the new cases.
We expected to see a spread of the virus amid the third wave. However, we didn't expect to see such high numbers, especially after we began public vaccination. Turkish government's trying to create a balance between people's health and economy. That's why it's trying to implement measures to contain the spread of the virus until at least 60% of the country is vaccinated.
Turkey is pressing ahead with its nationwide vaccination campaign using the Sinovac and Pfizer-BioNTech's vaccine shots. So far, more than 10.55 million people have been given the first doses, and 7.41 million were given the second. Turkey's announcement of a nationwide lockdown during the holy month of Ramadan has created chaos, which is seen by many as the reason behind the increasing number of daily infections. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and He's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way.